Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the System Club Masterclass. I've done some pretty good calls, I have to say, over the years. We interviewed Gary Bensavenga, who, when he was active in the industry, was universally considered the most successful direct mail copywriter of his era for several decades. Even his peers agreed that nobody could sell via mail like Gary. We have the only interview he ever gave in his 40-plus year career. We did an interview with the Ginsu knife guys. Here are two guys that found some knives that weren't selling very well in a supermarket and made a TV commercial, and by the time all the dust settled, they'd sold $1 billion worth of knives, and then Warren Buffett bought their company. As far as I know, the only other people to interview them in any depth was Harvard Business School. Another great interview that I look back on was interviewing the guys behind Blair Witch. And they started with a pretty shaky film, and by some luck, some craft, some cleverness, turned a pretty much a B-level or maybe D-level film into an indie superstar hit. Today we have a very interesting guy. I saw his book, and I was interested in the book in general, and then when I saw what he had done, some of the things he's done in his career, my positive alarm bell went off, and I said, I really would love to talk to this guy. His promotion, we're going to get into it in a second, what book I'm talking about and the promotion, it's got to be one of the top 10 book promotions of all time. And now, let's face it, the modern book industry is only about 150 years old, so we're really not talking back to papyruses. But when we talk about running a book through a press and moving lots and lots of copies, we're looking at about 150 years. And it's got to be top 10, could even be top 5. It reminds me of what Mark Twain did with the personal memoirs of Ulysses Grant. I don't know how many people realize that in addition to being a writer, Twain was also a publisher. And he published the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant and sold a gazillion copies for that era. He sold 350,000 copies. And for the late 19th century, that was a mega hit. He ended up paying the heirs of Ulysses Grant the equivalent of $10 million in real royalties, not in advance, but actual royalties. Another book that I think is sort of epic in the history of book publishing is Mary Baker Eddy's Science and Health with Key to Scriptures, which was the basis of Christian Science. And she sold an enormous number of books, and it became the basis of a church. The book that Jeff Hawkins promoted, you're going to recognize the title right away, and let me just tell you what it is. It's Dianetics. Some people may know that Dianetics is a book associated with an organization called Scientology. Some people call Scientology a church. Some people call Scientology a cult. One thing we can say objectively, it's an organization. Okay, I think it's also fair to say objectively, it's an authoritarian organization. And I would define that as any organization where you're not allowed to ask questions and where people who ask questions are punished. That's an authoritarian organization. So I'm trying to be objective about it. Some people may love Scientology, some people may hate it, but that's really not the topic of our discussion. I will say that if you want to understand Jeff's position these days, he's written a book called Leaving Scientology, an ebook that's just come out. That's not the book we're going to talk about today, but you know, they'll give you some indication of his position on Scientology these days. It's an ebook. It came out about a month ago. But we want to talk about Dianetics, and the reason is, as I was telling Jeff earlier, I'm 53, which means in the 80s I was in my 20s and I was living in New York City. And I'm telling you, you could not turn left, right, look up, down without seeing a copy of that book somewhere. It was a fantastically promoted book. And when I discovered that Jeff was the guy behind that, I was like, oh my God, I've got to meet this guy. I've got to talk with him, and maybe we could even interview him and learn some tricks of the trade. So, Jeff Hawkins, welcome. It's a real pleasure to have you on our call.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
So, Jeff, and by the way, Counterfeit Dreams is a really interesting book in its own right. It's Jeff's personal story, and I, as anybody who knows me, I've got stacks of books all over the place, and a lot of them never even get opened. Many of them do get skimmed, but it's rare that I'll sit down and read from beginning to end, and I did with this book. It's a fascinating story in its own right, independent of the book selling, but of course that's what we're going to focus on. So Jeff, Dianetics, you got charged with the task of getting this book, which was considered a core document, out to the world as a way of building the organization. Is that pretty much the way this thing got rolling?
Yeah, pretty much. L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of the religion, he was really insistent that the primary way to get the word out was to get this book, Dianetics, out to as many people as possible. And of course, that was a challenge to me because it had been a bestseller in 1950, and the book was 40-some years old at that point. So it's an old book. It's been out. It's been on the bestseller list. It's come and gone. And it was sort of my task to resurrect it.
Wow. I didn't realize that it had had a life before. I mean, that's even trickier in some ways, to take something that's had its run and resurrect it. What time period are we talking about? Because, again, I'm remembering the 80s being the time when that book was literally everywhere.
Yeah, we started in 82. We started the campaign in the fall of 82.
When would you say that it ran its course or changed character? And that's one of the things in your book. You talk about how the organization changed its attitude towards books and books as a promotion method. And the promotion started in 82.
Yeah, it was pretty much done by about 1988, 89, somewhere in there. It had pretty much run its course. And at that point, Hubbard was dead, and the organization shifted onto other things, and they weren't so interested in book marketing anymore.
So the book was everywhere, so how did you do it? I mean, it's sort of a big, broad question. Maybe how did you start, and then what did you learn as you went along, and what were the big ahas, and what did you realize was working like gangbusters and then pushed harder? How did it evolve?
I'll tell you sort of how it started. The church had gone out to big book chains. And of course, you got to remember, this is the 1980s. This is back in the dark ages. You know, there was no internet or anything. And so in order to get a book selling, you had to go to the major book chains, which at that time was B. Dalton, Walden Books, a few others. And you had to convince them to do a big distribution. You had to get it into the main warehousers, which at that time was Ingram's. And every time the church had gone to talk to these people, they had dismissed them as a bunch of kooks, basically. And we hired a wonderful, wonderful man named Len Foreman, who used to be VP marketing for Simon & Schuster, great guy. And we used him as a kind of a salesman. And he went to all of the major book chains, and they knew him. And he convinced them that, okay, these guys are serious. They really are going to run a campaign. And he got agreement to get the book into all the major chains. It wasn't the huge, what they call a sell-in. It was a couple hundred thousand books to start with out into the bookstores. And then we had to scramble and sell it.
Did you say 100,000 books?
It was a couple hundred thousand books in the original sell-in because we were pitching them. We were saying, oh, we're going to do a big campaign.
Wow.
And Len was convincing enough that he could go and sell it to them. And they're like, okay, you know, realizing, of course, that if you don't sell them, we get them all back as returns.
That might be a good sidebar. I think it was during the Depression, the book retailing industry created this strange business practice where if you send them the book, if they don't sell it, they can return it to you.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy.
Yeah. So you could have ended up eating 200,000 books.
Exactly. Exactly.
And this is an important thing because printing 200,000 books and selling 200,000 books is a totally different thing. I know it seems obvious, but believe me, there are people with garages full of books that they haven't been able to sell yet that, you know, didn't get that.
Yeah. So anyway, my next task was to reach people with a message and sell it. And I did a lot of research, number one, into the type of people who had already become Scientologists. And I analyzed them six ways from Sunday. What was their education level, male or female, you know, relationship? Where did they live? Did they live in urban areas, rural areas? You know, there were just so many analyses of where did our current membership come from? And what kind of people are likely to join Scientology? And what I found was that it was majority were young people, say, 20 to 35, something like that, college educated, not necessarily graduates, but some college. And so I got to know these people very well in terms of, like, who's our target audience.
In your book, too, you mentioned something else, that they tended to have the quality of being seekers. I mean, they were a certain age, they were a certain education background, but they also tended to be people who were looking.
Yeah, they're looking for something. Yeah. that's when I sort of got into the sort of, you know, psychological profile of these people. Why did they get into Scientology? And the answer is they were looking for something. You know, they were searching for something.
Do you recall, how did you get the raw data that gave you the demographics to even be able to analyze it?
I did a number of surveys on existing Scientologists who had already joined.
Okay. You just surveyed your members.
The members. And I said, when you joined, what age were you? How much education have you had? Where were you living? How were you first contacted? What appealed to you about it? Just extensive, extensive surveys on our existing membership. And that gave me a profile of who I should go for.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
And by the way, not everybody in the church agreed with this. I got into a lot of trouble for this because they're saying, well, no, we're trying to appeal to everybody. And I said, yeah, no, you can't do that. You can't appeal to everybody. You got to narrow cast, what was later called niche marketing. You got to find your niche.
Yep. This is such a classic marketing error on the one hand, and you took such a classic correct path. The error is, oh, my product's for everybody, which is absurd. But the correct thing, and very few businesses do this, even today with all the tools we have available, very few businesses get to know their customers, especially smallish businesses, and figure out these basic demographic things. I have, just as a real quick sidebar, I have a guy that taught me a tremendous amount who sold a lot of books in his own right, a guy named Dan Kennedy. And he tells this story about, I forget what kind of a company was, it was, but this company discovered that its best customer was a rural guy, a rural male who liked to get crew cuts, you know, who typically had a crew cut. So they ended up marketing through rural barbers because they knew the rural barbers knew exactly who was getting a crew cut. And that turned out to be, it wasn't a hair product, by the way, it was something completely different, but that was their ideal person. And they went, they figured that out, and they used that information to reach the market. And so what you did was another example of this. So young, 20 to 35, some college education, and people that were looking for something as opposed to, let's say, super conventional or conformist people.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have your data.
So the next question became how to reach them. I was doing a lot of study on media at the time, and of course, and this is in the 80s, cost per thousand in terms of media was lowest for something like TV. Well, of course, there's a reason for that, because you're not narrowcasting. You're like firing a shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
If you book a TV show in those days, because there was only a limited number of channels, if you booked ads on TV, you were getting everybody pretty much. So my question was, okay, I like the cost per thousand on TV, but it's too much of a broad shoot. So I started investigating what kind of television programs my target audience watches.
Mm-hmm.
And I found things like Twilight Zone reruns.
Oh, my goodness.
So any science fiction movie, very popular. Old classic films from the 40s and 50s, very popular. And so I went through the program lists, and I had a media company at the time, and they were dead set against my strategy. They said, this is not the way you buy media. You know, you're going for target points. And to them, target points mean how many 20 to 35-year-old predominantly male people, you know, I was reaching. And they had me booked on Saturday morning cartoons. And I said, I don't want to reach people that are watching Saturday morning cartoons. I don't care what you say. That is not my target audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I eventually went through a couple of media firms. I finally found somebody that got it. And I said, listen, let's just book the shows that we know they're going to watch. And some of it was really, really subjective. And it was based on my understanding of this audience. And, you know, they would say, well, here's this science program. I'd go book it. That's good. And then they'd say, here's this, you know, whatever. And I'd say, no, that's not my audience. A subjective, knowing that I'm looking at intelligent seekers.
Gotcha.
You know, who are looking for something unusual. They're not looking for the mundane. They're looking for something unusual. So their television choices would reflect that.
So anything that resonated with that was something that you felt was worth a test.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
So, and I don't think anybody had had advertised books on TV before that. It wasn't a thing that was done. I was told by many of the book people, you can't sell books with TV ads. But we did, and we did because I figured out how to narrowcast it.
Were the rates pretty good for, let's say, a science fiction rerun? That strikes me as maybe even a good deal in terms of a media buy.
Well, yeah.
So you got good value as well as the right market.
Oh, yeah, because we weren't going for the mainstream primetime shows, not at all. I was going for the fringe shows.
Got it.
And they were not that expensive. And this is another thing I got in trouble with, because, of course, the executives were going, why aren't we on primetime? Why aren't we on primetime? And I had to explain this strategy to them, which a lot of them did not understand.
Mm-hmm.
At least they gave me enough leeway to carry out my strategy. And, of course, once they saw it work, they were like, yeah, whatever you want to do.
Gotcha. So you had the books in the stores. You had analysis of your prospects, found media that looked promising. Then what did you do?
Well, then we launched the campaign, and we had an immediate response. It wasn't as huge as we thought, but it was decent. I mean, I remember first week out of the two main chains, we sold maybe 500 books.
Okay.
That doesn't sound like a lot, but there are not many books that sold 500 copies out of the two major chains at any given week.
Okay.
So it was enough to get their attention, and it was enough to get onto their bestseller list. This was on their nonfiction list. We ended up at number 10 or 15 or something like that. And, of course, everybody was overjoyed because we were on the bestseller list. And you don't have to sell that many books to be on the bestseller list on a weekly basis.
Okay.
At least in those days you didn't. And then we just kept hammering. And I did a lot of testing, a lot of media testing. And I was, of course, watching the sales through the major chains, weekly reports from the major chains. And I was watching those sales and monitoring them and making incremental changes and then seeing what happened to the sales. And I discovered that we didn't have enough money to stay on the hole constantly every week. And also, we were not buying nationally, by the way. We were buying spot market.
Okay.
The spot markets were chosen based on my research, where and they were main urban centers, LA, New York, and so forth. We were focusing in on spot markets, and we were doing not huge, but decent buys in the spot markets and focusing in on our target group.
Okay.
And we couldn't stay on every time. And I discovered after some trial and error that if I pulsed it 3 weeks on and 2 weeks off, that the relaunch would catch the sales before they bottomed out. So it would go up and then down, but not quite to the bottom, and then up again and down, but not quite as low.
Okay.
And I could, by pulsing the media, I could get the sales to climb pretty regularly, you know, on a pretty regular basis. I mean, there were a lot of things that added into it. About 86, this is about 4 years into the campaign, cable was deregulated. And nobody knew what to do with cable. Most of the advertisers were staying out of it because it wasn't rated by Nielsen. It was a pig and a poke. Nobody knew what they were going to get, so everybody was staying out of cable. I went over it with my media people, and I said, okay, what are the demographics of cable? They told me, and it was a match.
Mm.
It was an exact match. And I went, good, let's put our next buy into cable. And they said, don't test it. And I go, no, I just want to do it because it's so perfect, and it's national. And I developed some new ads you may have seen where questions appear in text on a black screen.
Right. I have seen, yeah. I don't know if you were aware, but that is a kind of an old mail order method for selling books, too. Put questions that are answered in the book, in the ads.
Yeah.
Yeah. You did this with TV spots.
Yeah. Well, it started out as a mail order ad, and I had all these arrows pointing into the book with questions. And then I was going over, and I said, well, why don't we do this as a TV ad and just have the questions appear with the page number where the answer is found? And then not say what it's from, and then boom, say the book is Dianetics.
Hmm. Did the ads explicitly drive people to the stores?
Yeah, and it was all to drive them into the retail stores, all of it.
Gotcha.
And one of the things, it was kind of like opposite day when I was putting this ad together, because I took everything that was currently being done on TV ads. This is mid-80s. A lot of glitz, a lot of, you know, color, light, boom, boom. And I said, let's do the opposite. Let's go minimal. Let's go white letters on black. The score was kind of an electronic Tangerine Dream kind of tense staccato.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was minimal, and I designed it so that it would be different from anything else on television. And if that ad came on, people would go, "What the hell is that?" Because all they hear is this tense, dramatic music. And they're like, "What's happening?" Even if they're in the next room, they would go, "What is happening on the television?" The questions were designed to suck them in and say, "Well, can a person's confidence be improved? Can this, can that?" And I got told by some of the booksellers that they had people racing into the store and finding the book and turning to that page to find the answer, you know?
I'm sure. And, you know, now that you mention those ads, I'm remembering them. It's almost impression, the feeling. I remember watching television and having these different ads appear, and they were different. They did stand out. There's a great advertising guy, I'm sure you know his name, David Ogilvy. And
yeah.
He used to tell his executives, look, don't look at your ad. He was mainly dealing with print. He did do TV too, but he mainly was excelling in print. And he would tell his executives, look, don't look at your ad on a easel in the boardroom. And he would actually embed proposed ads in mock-up New York Times, mock-up Life magazine, so that you could see how the ad would look in amongst all the other ads. And so you were doing the same thing with TV. You were deliberately trying to stand out.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what about the volcano ad? Wasn't that a theme? Was that you using it in the selling of the book?
That was also on the cover since about 1968. Hubbard always had that on the cover. It has mystical significance in the whole Scientology belief system.
Ah, okay.
So that's why the volcano's on there. But I'd say if I did anything, I cropped in on it close. And then we eventually did animate the volcano. It was one of the first computer graphics ads that was ever done, I think, CGI.
Oh, okay.
Ads. We animated the volcano. Interestingly, we were dealing with a firm. It took them about 6 weeks to make this thing. It's the kind of thing that a kid could do on his desktop computer in about 2 days
nowadays.
But then it took this whole room full of geeks about 6 weeks to do it, you know?
Yep. Oh, sure. So you had the spots running. People were seeing those questions, and they were burning a hole in their minds, and they had to get an answer, and they went to the stores and found the book. And of course, now they've got the book in their hand.
Yeah.
If you can accomplish that, you're probably 9/10 of the way to selling it.
We had good sales. We built it up. By about 1987, we were selling 30,000 books a week through the bookstores.
Wow. So from your first week, where you were selling 500, which was already excellent, you were doing 30,000 books a week, week in and week out.
Yeah, and it was on the New York Times bestseller list for over a year, on their nonfiction list. Hmm. And it was on all the major bestseller lists for about a year or two. And, of course, that generated its own word of mouth.
Oh, sure. Now, I remember from the book that later you marketed a seminar. Was that related to this promotion, or was that a separate thing?
This was when the book campaign started to sort of get in disfavor, and I was told by the church executives, well, we've sold all these books, but where are the people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had more information cards in the books, and about 5% of the people who bought books sent those cards in. Those cards went to the local organization, and most of the organizations, the local churches, that was their main source of new people. Well, I knew this, but I couldn't convince the powers that be that this was happening in the campaign. And they were saying, no, we need to put the emphasis now on to selling seminars. And that's a whole nother story. I ended up developing a do-it-yourself How to Do Dianetics package, which we were selling, I think, for $29.95 or something like that. And I ended up writing and producing an infomercial.
Oh, really?
For it. And we ended up selling about 40,000 of those kits. And then we set up a 1-800 helpline. People call in for technical help with using Dianetics. And then from there, we got to come into the organizations for seminars and all this sort of thing. So we were starting to build it up. But this was when the church was starting to become more insular and more cult-like, and the person who is currently in charge had no interest in that.
Mm.
He had no interest in any of these big campaigns, which was sort of my forte.
Yeah. Everything that you're describing is just classic direct marketing. What was your background in direct marketing previous to this?
All of my experience was working for the church, and I just did a lot of outside study, basically, and some mail order court. I was just studying at that point.
I remember in the 80s, there wasn't a lot of good instruction in mail order marketing. There was some, but it's not like today where, you know, it's everywhere. But in those days, you really had to look hard for it.
Yeah. And I also was consulting with and hiring some people who were pretty expert in that whole infomercial field. And I kind of, you know, picked their brain a lot in terms of what do you do, how do you say it. And so the infomercial we produced was just in the classic infomercial format, you know, basically 8 minutes of sell and then a 2 or 3 minute call to action and then another 8 minutes of sell and so forth, you know.
Were there any particular books or resources or experts that would be accessible to people now? That's why I mentioned books that were particularly motivational or helpful for you in helping you form your approach to this way of selling books?
Yes. Tim Hawthorne.
Oh, Tim Hawthorne, of course. Infomercial guy.
Yeah. He wrote The Complete Guide to Infomercial Marketing.
Ah, okay.
I devoured that and then picked his brain some more in terms of how that was. There was another lady I worked with. I forget her name, but she was a pretty well-established infomercial writer. And I consulted with her, and we went back and forth on the script I was working on. We worked with Williams Television Time, which I think is, I'm not sure if they're still operating, Katie Williams.
Mm-hmm. I recognize the name.
Yeah, very, very expert at booking infomercials. And I also worked with Jan Gildersleeve in L.A., who worked for Ron Popeil for years and years and did his infomercial media buying.
She must have been very good then.
Yeah, no, she knew her stuff. She definitely knew her stuff, you know. So I had some good sort of consultants and learned a lot from them, basically.
Great, great. So going back to this number of 30,000 books a week, so how long did you maintain that? Because that's a pretty blistering pace. And again, let's remember, everybody, this is not a romance novel or something that somebody takes to the beach. I mean, this is sort of a self-improvement book that, you know, is kind of challenging.
I mean, we kept momentum up for a while, but my budgets got cut in half as of about 1989. My budgets were cut in half, and then they were cut further from there. So, but we maintained momentum. The sales kind of stay in that range probably for about a year and then just started dropping after that, and they never regained that pace.
Gotcha. You have your book, which came out recently, Counterfeit Dreams, which is a larger narrative of your whole experience with Scientology.
Exactly.
And then this ebook that just came out, which is Leaving Scientology, which is, I guess, a guide, or maybe it's a narrative too. I don't really know what's in that book because I haven't read it yet.
I call it A Guide to Exit and Recovery. It's a lot of it is just my thought processes. I kind of peel away the onion layers of indoctrination.
One of the hot things these days, I'm sure you know, is marketing via Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
Is it available via Kindle?
Yes. Well, Leaving Scientology is only available on Kindle as an ebook. Counterfeit Dreams is both. It's both on Kindle and in hardback, as a hardback book.
Gotcha. Are you doing any other, or have you done any other book promotions? Or if not, what kinds of things are you doing these days?
I have a little design studio here in Portland, and we do websites, a lot of collateral material, catalogs, flyers, and that sort of thing. Just basically any kind of design work. I don't do the big marketing campaigns anymore. I'm mainly just working as a boutique design agency.
And yet the people that hire you, they're getting somebody that's done some pretty remarkable things with promotion.
They do get my marketing background, so that's an advantage over, say, the usual graphic designer. You know, I have a sensibility for such things as target audiences and impact and things like that.
If somebody's interested in contacting you, do you work with people from afar, or is it mostly local?
No, we have clients that are all over the place. The website is called skyhawkstudios.com.
And it's Hawk is singular, so skyhawkstudios.com. And there people can find out more about your design work, and which includes, you said, web work as well as print collateral?
Yeah, website, print collateral, and I do some 3D modeling and animation.
Oh, really?
work as well. Yeah. So we have an online portfolio at that website, and you can check out our work.
Great. Did I miss anything? Any big points in the promotion of Dianetics? We started out by talking about how meticulous you were about getting to understand the current members of the organization. And that helped you form a couple of things. Number one, how you would pitch them. Mm-hmm. But also number two, where you would pitch them. And it's fascinating that you came up with the idea of, hey, science fiction reruns, science programs, 40s and 50 movies, and I guess anything that kind of was fringe and different and interesting that was on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you'd hit on some very clever methods to get people to actually go to the store and literally go right to the shelf. And I can imagine that helping. I can imagine that happening thousands of times.
Yeah.
Somebody would have a question that would just stick in their mind and they'd go to the bookstore. And for our younger listeners, there was a time when you couldn't go to Amazon. It's hard to imagine such a day, but if you wanted to see a book, you actually had to get yourself into a bookstore to take a look at it. And of course, that's a heck of a great selling environment to have somebody actually pick the book up in hand in a bookstore where there's a cash register in the back. It hardly gets better. And then we talked about the fact, some of the things that you did to sell the seminar. Was the 1-800 helpline in the books, or was it something that you promoted independently of that?
It was inside the package. It called this number for technical assistance, and we had some Dianetics specialists who would those phones and talk to people. I talked to them myself. If there was a call overload, I would pick up the phones and talk to them.
And when you talked about fine-tuning, you were always checking the sales and the results. Could you recall offhand any particular things that happened that made you think, okay, we need to buy more of this or less of that, or we need to tune this up or tune that down? Just wondering if anything sticks out after all these years.
No, I don't remember the specifics, just what we've talked about. But yeah, I was constantly testing new ads, new patterns. Frankly, we would produce an ad and put it on, and the sales would go down, and that was the end of that ad. It never saw the light of day after that, you know? But if an ad was producing sales, we'd run it forever.
Gotcha. And you'd use 3 weeks on, 2 weeks off.
Yeah, pulsing.
Yeah, pulsing. That's interesting. I never heard of that before, but that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, Jeff Hawkins, author of Counterfeit Dreams, which is available in print and in ebook. Also, Leaving Scientology, which is available in ebook. He's also the head of SkyhawkStudios.com, which does web work and collateral work and some 3D animation, all informed by his experience of, I have to say, one of the biggest, let's say, non-traditional. I guess the reason why I started the interview out referring to the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant and Science and Health, that book that launched Christian Science, is those books were also outside of the normal marketing channels. Now, of course, your books were sold through a store.
Yeah.
You were using methods that were not traditional to book publishing. You were really, to use an overused phrase, you were outside the box in your thinking and in your approach.
Yeah, we were definitely outside of the normal. We didn't go through an agency or anything like that. It was all in-house.
And it's hard to imagine that you would have been anywhere even remotely as successful as you were had you left it up to an agency. Whenever you see a big success story like this, you know there's always some guy in the background working like mad, obsessed with getting the ball across the goal line. And that sounds like that was you on the book Dianetics during the 1980s. Well, Jeff, thank you for the time. Thank you for sharing this experience that you had and the insights that you developed along the way. It's fascinating to me, and I know a lot of our listeners are going to take ideas that they can use. I mean, a lot of this, just fundamentals, and yet so few businesses of any kind, whether they're marketers or book marketers, apply the fundamentals. You know, they don't take the time to get to know their customers. They don't think creatively about ways to reach them. They don't test. They just run an ad and hope for the best, and they don't have the ability to switch out new ads and keep trying until they get an ad that really works. All these things are kind of common sense, but I think take this full circle, as Mark Twain said, the promoter of one of the best selling books of the 19th century, common sense is not common.
Right.
So great, Jeff, thanks again. And anybody who's interested in the story in depth, the book is Counterfeit Dreams. And anybody interested in working with Jeff as a designer, I would check out his site, Skyhawk, singular, SkyhawkStudios.com. Jeff Hawkins, thanks a lot.
Great, thank you.